Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. July is the time we celebrate our nation's independence. On today's show, we'll be telling you about some recent Supreme Court rulings that will have a big impact on the rights and liberties of people across our nation. Those decisions include major cases affecting immigrants, gun rights, affirmative action, abortion access, and blood tests for drunk drivers. Then on our Capitol Report, we'll have results of the FBI investigation into Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's email controversy and news about a shocking lawsuit accusing Republican presidential presumptive nominee Donald Trump of raping a 13-year-old girl, an allegation that Trump denies. We'll have some troubling reports in the aftermath of the border fire, including controversies over a search for a couple found dead after the fire by volunteers, a soldier's family who lost their home in the blaze, and the valiant efforts of community members and organizations to rescue animals trapped in the evacuated area. Now, if you're looking for some stress relief, on Destination East County, we'll have all the most fun festivals and events coming up across East County in July and early August, from parades and festivals to theatrical productions, concerts, stargazing parties, night fishing, and much, much more. Finally, we'll be re-airing our interview with Lisa Wood, a long rider sharing her adventures riding horseback across America. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. President Barack Obama's executive orders to protect an estimated 5 million immigrants, or nearly half the 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, from deportation, have been blocked by the United States Supreme Court. The action puts many immigrants brought here as children and parents of undocumented immigrants at risk of deportation. Their fate now depends on the outcome of the next election. The High Court ruling also takes away new health care coverage recently granted by California to certain undocumented people. Here's what you need to know. The justices split 4-4 on the ruling due to the vacancy left on the High Court by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. A tie vote means a lower court ruling to block the president's orders will stand. The tie in the case, United States versus Texas, lets the lower court decision stand, blocking two of the president's executive orders. One of those programs, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents, also known as DAPA, would have given temporary work permits to parents of U.S. citizens and legal residents. The other program is an expansion of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program known as DACA, which gave a reprieve to certain people brought to the U.S. as children. The president's order specifically would have protected young people who arrived in the U.S. before 2010 to be eligible for protection against deportation. This ruling will not affect those who came here before 2007, since they were already protected. The decision is causing sadness and panic in immigrant communities. Antonio Bernabe, organizing director for the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, states that immigrants hoping for a real solution are disappointed. He adds, "Now they are still fearing for their families, fearing for themselves, living in terror every day," Public News Service reports. Bernabe says his community will fight on, organizing to elect candidates at every level of government who support immigration reform, something Congress has failed to pass for years. Mark Arabo is a spokesperson for the Western U.S. Chaldean Catholic Diocese and for the Minority Humanitarian Foundation in San Diego, an organization that has rescued over 400 Iraqi Chaldean Christians from persecution in Iraq. The group hopes to help another 700,000 Christians still facing persecution from ISIS, the Islamic State. San Diego is home to 60,000 or more Chaldean immigrants, many of whom have held rallies in El Cajon, pleading for the American government to help their loved ones still in the Middle East. In 2014, El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells told thousands of local Chaldeans at a rally in front of City Hall to tell their relatives fleeing ISIS that if they come here, they will be safe and they will be welcome. But now, they are neither safe nor welcome in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling. Arabo calls the Supreme Court action alarming for immigrant families everywhere, but it is particularly frightening for Chaldeans, He adds, people who came here to escape religious persecution and extermination at the hands of ISIS are now being told they have to go back. They're terrified, he says. Thomas Sams, president and general counsel for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, argued the case before the Supreme Court back in April. The case is still alive, he said, and it has two paths back to the high court. This is only a preliminary injunction, so it has to go back to the district court, and the judge there has to reach a final decision, Sams explained. That final decision could then end up back before the Supreme Court, and in addition, right now, there could be a petition for rehearing by a full court. The next U.S. president will fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court and determine the new majority. Obama took the executive action only after Congress refused to approve comprehensive immigration reforms. The lawsuit before the Supreme Court was filed by 26 states seeking to block the protections against deportations for immigrant families. The ruling doesn't necessarily mean that deportations will begin immediately, since Obama previously directed Homeland Security to focus deportation efforts only on criminals who broke laws other than coming here without documentation. Obama and some legal scholars have noted that the High Court did not rule directly on whether presidential executive orders themselves are constitutional, instead focusing on specifics of allowing or blocking deportations to commence while awaiting that trial court hearing on this original case. But House Speaker Paul Ryan proclaims that the Supreme Court's ruling makes the president's executive action on immigration null and void. Speaker Ryan, a Republican, adds, the Constitution is clear. The president is not permitted to write laws, only Congress is. This is another major victory in our fight to restore the separation of powers, Speaker Ryan says. After the ruling, speaking at the White House, President Obama made clear that the future of the American dream for immigrants is at stake in the next election. The president says, we're going to have to make a decision about whether we are a people who tolerate the hypocrisy of a system where the workers who pick our fruit or make our beds never have the chance to get right with the law, or whether we're going to give them a chance, just like our forebears had a chance to take responsibility and give their kids a better future. Nearly two-thirds of Americans, 63%, say that the president's deferred action policy for young immigrants should continue, according to a Bloomberg Politics survey in November. And that makes the High Court and the Republican majority in Congress clearly out of step with mainstream American views. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has called for deportation of all undocumented immigrants with no exceptions. He praised the Supreme Court decision, stating on Thursday, today's 4-4 Supreme Court ruling has blocked one of the most unconstitutional actions ever undertaken by a president. He adds, the split decision makes clear what is at stake in November, the Washington Post reports. But Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton says a tie vote by the Supreme Court blocking President Barack Obama's immigration plan is unacceptable. Clinton said the High Court's action is a reminder of the harm Donald Trump would do to immigrant families and how much damage Senate Republicans are causing by refusing to consider Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland. Mrs. Clinton said that as president, she would do everything possible under the law to go further to protect families. The Senate's Republican leadership has refused to hold confirmation hearings on Garland or any nominee proposed by President Obama for the Supreme Court vacancy, insisting that that decision be left to the next president who will take office in January. The ruling also halts California's recent decision to allow a 500,000 undocumented immigrants protection under DACA from deportation to be eligible for state-funded health insurance through Medicaid. Governor Jerry Brown signed a law last year allowing undocumented children to sign up for Medi-Cal. And earlier this month, the governor signed a second bill to let undocumented immigrants buy insurance through the state health exchange, although without the subsidies that citizens receive. But now, the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling will deprive an estimated 1.5 million Californians of opportunities for health care, the Los Angeles Times reports, or over half of all the uninsured people in California. The High Court's decision will no doubt fuel record turnout among Latinos, Chaldeans, and other voters in immigrant communities this November. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Bill Driscoll with news about a landmark Supreme Court action to protect victims of domestic violence. The ruling also indicates that some limits on gun ownership are constitutional when a person has demonstrated that they are a risk to harm someone. By a 6-2 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a federal law that allows a person to be banned for life from owning a gun if the person commits domestic abuse recklessly, even if the actions were not premeditated. The case, Voisin versus the United States, challenged the Lautenberg Amendment to the federal 2006 Gun Control Act. At least 18 states have similar measures prohibiting convicted abusers from owning guns. The case was brought by two men in Maine who lost their rights to own guns after being convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors. Both had extensive records of violence. Voisin pled guilty to beating up his girlfriend in 2003 and again in 2005. Federal authorities later found that he had shot and killed a baby bald eagle. He was charged for killing an endangered bird and illegally possessing a gun. The co-plaintiff, William Armstrong III, was twice convicted of beating his wife in 2002 and in 2008. Both times he was charged with a misdemeanor, not a felony. After police searched his home for drugs, they found six guns and charged him with illegal weapons possession. The National Domestic Hotline provided evidence to the court in its brief, indicating that reckless acts to which domestic violence victims in America had been subjected include a woman who said her husband shot at her feet, another who said her partner sat on her chest and pointed a gun at her temple, and a third who reported that her abuser played Russian roulette and even pulled the trigger. But fortunately, the bullet was not in the chamber that fired. The only group to weigh in on behalf of Voisin and Anderson was Gun Owners of America, a gun rights organization that filed an amicus brief arguing that a misdemeanor conviction should not be sufficient grounds to deprive a U.S. citizen of a right to bear arms under the Second Amendment, which protects the right of Americans to a well-armed militia. Justices Clarence Thomas and Sonia Sotomayor dissented from the majority opinion, raising concerns over denying individuals a constitutional right potentially for life. But safety of victims proved paramount to the majority of justices. In a domestic violence situation, the presence of a gun increases the likelihood of death sixfold, and far too often, a reckless action escalates into murder. While the case addressed only domestic violence cases, a similar logic might be in the future applied to uphold other limits on gun ownership, such as if any individual is on a terrorist watch list, has been convicted of other violent crimes or actions, such as recklessly threatening people at a school or workplace, or has a history of mental illness that could make that person a danger to others. Kim Gandy, president of the National Network to End Domestic Violence, praised the high court's action, noting that courts are often lenient on abusers, and prosecutors often charge or settle cases as misdemeanors instead of felonies, making it hard to protect victims from future abuse. She concludes, "The Supreme Court today affirmed what we know. Domestic violence escalates and is often deadly. Ensuring that convicted abusers do not have access to firearms will save lives."
By a slim 43 margin, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that affirmative action is legal and that it's constitutional for public colleges and universities to consider race as a factor for admission. But the court also cautioned that educators must also show that other means of addressing diversity have failed. Justice Elena Kagan recused herself due to her prior involvement with the case, and the seat held by the late Justice Antonin Scalia remains vacant. The case was filed by a white applicant to the University of Texas, which used academic standards as a criteria for 75% of admissions, but included race as one of several factors in 25% of admissions. The ruling won't affect California, which already prohibits the use of race in public college or university admissions. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report on a landmark Supreme Court ruling upholding reproductive rights for women. A Texas law that aimed to shut down most of the state's abortion clinics, forcing some women seeking the procedure to drive hundreds of miles, has been overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court as unconstitutional in a 5-3 ruling. The decision is expected to impact at least 25 other states that have enacted similar restrictions. One day later, the court refused to hear appeals filed by Mississippi and Alabama, which had similar laws. The newly passed Mississippi statute would have shut down the only abortion clinic in that state if it had gone into effect. The Texas law required abortion clinics to meet surgical center operating standards and for doctors to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. But in some cases, there is no hospital nearby. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, said that the state's goal was to, quote, protect innocent life while ensuring the highest health and safety standards for women. But the court's majority found just the opposite, that medical risks for women would actually rise as a result of the law. The court chose science over emotional appeals or religious doctrine. The risk of a woman dying after childbirth is actually 10 times higher than the risk of dying after an abortion, according to a study in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology. That study looked at deaths from 1998 to 2005, when only one woman died for every 167,000 abortions performed, while the rate of death from childbirth was 1 in 11,000 births. Moreover, a 2014 study in the journal Contraception found abortion to be less risky than dentistry, plastic surgery, bicycle riding, or running marathons. The law mandated shutdown of all but 10 clinics in Texas, and 9 of the remaining ones would be clustered in major cities. Women in San Antonio would have had to go out of state into New Mexico to obtain an abortion or drive a distance roughly equivalent to going from San Diego to San Francisco. Rural areas would have been left with no abortion providers at all. Justice Stephen Breyer, writing for the majority on the Supreme Court, noted that the Texas effort to shut down clinics put obstacles in the way of women seeking pre-viability abortions, forcing them to wait until later in pregnancy or carry the pregnancies to term. Justice Breyer wrote, "The closures mean fewer doctors, longer waiting times, increased crowding, and significantly greater travel distances, all of which, when taken together, burden a woman's right to choose." He was joined in the majority by Justices Anthony Kennedy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. Chief Justice John Roberts, Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito dissented. Justice Thomas made clear that he was prepared to find abortion itself unconstitutional, a protection in place since the 1972 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in the U.S. Justice Thomas wrote, "This suit is only possible because the court has allowed abortion clinics and physicians to invoke a putative constitutional right that does not belong to them, a woman's right to abortion." Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton called the decision a victory for women in Texas and across America, but made clear in her message sent on Twitter, "This fight isn't over. The next president has to protect women's health." Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, has not yet commented on the ruling, but last week he told an anti-abortion organization that he would appoint a Supreme Court justice who would overturn Roe v. Wade. There is currently a vacancy on the High Court due to the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. The Republican-controlled Senate has refused to confirm or even hold hearings on President Obama's appointee, Merrick Garland, nor any other Obama appointee to the High Court. Thus, the next president will have power to tip the balance on the Supreme Court. Congress also plays a role in women's reproductive rights, with many restrictive measures that have recently been introduced, including a bill by Congressman Duncan Hunter that would have declared life begins at conception, banning virtually all abortions, and setting up a challenge to Roe v. Wade itself if the measure had ever become law. Doug Applegate, who is running against San Diego Congressman Daryl Issa, praised the High Court's decision as a victory for women across the nation. Applegate concludes, "Daryl Issa and Donald Trump want to deny women access to the health care services they need. We need more leaders in Congress willing to take a stand to support women's rights."
Suspected drunk drivers can refuse to take a blood test without a warrant, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled. But the court also ruled that the drivers must submit to a less invasive breath test when ordered, or face arrest. 5 justices side with the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Samuel Alito, Stephen Breyer, and Elena Kagan. 2 others, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor, believed warrants should be required for both blood and breath tests. Conservative Justice Clarence Thomas contended that police should not need warrants for either test. Law enforcement had argued that delays in getting warrants could enable some drunk drivers to get off the hook, since blood alcohol content diminishes over time. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jisato Iverson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
FBI Director James B. Comey announced Tuesday that his agency will not recommend criminal charges against Hillary Clinton for her use of a private email server as Secretary of State. He called the handling of emails by Clinton and her staff, quote, extremely careless, end quote, adding, quote, although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case, end quote. The final decision will be up to the Justice Department. Clinton campaign spokesman Brian Fallon issued a statement which reads, quote, we are pleased that the career officials handling this case have determined that no further action by the department is appropriate. As the secretary has long said, it was a mistake to use her personal email and she would not do it again, end quote. Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump blasted the FBI announcement in a tweet which reads, the system is rigged. Trump claimed former general and CIA director David H. Petraeus got in trouble for far less. Petraeus pled guilty to a misdemeanor after he was accused of sharing classified information with a woman with whom he was having an affair, but he was not criminally charged. The FBI spent hours interviewing Hillary Clinton on Saturday. Her husband, former President Bill Clinton, drew criticism for chatting privately with U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch last week while both were traveling through the same airport. Lynch later said she would step aside from making any decision in the investigation to avoid a perceived conflict of interest. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alpert.
For the third time, a woman has accused Donald Trump of sexual assault, but this time, an eyewitness has come forward to support an allegation of rape. The witness attests that she worked as a party planner for Jeffrey Epstein, a notorious pedophile, registered sex offender, and hedge fund manager. In a sworn declaration, the witness, identified as Tiffany Doe, states that she saw Donald Trump rape a 13-year-old girl, identified as Jane Doe, at Epstein's home in 1994. Trump is now the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. Tiffany Doe says her job was to get attractive adolescent girls to attend parties at Epstein's estate. She says she saw both Epstein and Trump perform sexual acts with Jane Doe and that both men knew the girl was only 13 years old. Jane Doe initially filed a case which was dismissed due to technical filing errors, but last week, now represented by an attorney, she refiled the case against Trump in federal court. She alleges that Trump assaulted her on four separate occasions at Epstein's home where she was held against her will after responding to a modeling job. Those alleged assaults included tying her to a bed, raping her, and striking her in the face, the declaration states. The alleged victim also claims Trump threatened that she and her family would be physically harmed if not killed if she ever told anyone what happened. She further claimed Trump told her about a 12-year-old named Maria who vanished after being forced into sexual acts. The 5-year statute of limitations on rape charges in New York has run out. But Jane Doe's attorney is arguing that the court should invoke something called tolling, a legal procedure for stopping the clock due to duress she was under because of threats, she says. He has cited other New York cases where tolling was allowed, Huffington Post reports. Tiffany Doe, the witness, claims she is only now coming forward because she, too, feared for her life and her family's safety. Donald Trump has denied all of these allegations, calling them disgusting at the highest level. He suggests the accusations are politically motivated, Daily Wire reports. But several years ago, when asked about his then-decades-old relationship with Epstein, Trump called Epstein a terrific guy, adding, he's a lot of fun to be with. It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. Epstein's predilections for young teen girls are well documented. He was sentenced to 13 months for sexually abusing a minor and must register as a Level 3 sex offender, the most dangerous category. But the Sun Sentinel reports that court records show he was accused of sexually assaulting at least 30 young girls at his Florida estate or aboard his private plane. In a 2010 deposition, Epstein was asked by the attorney for one of the alleged victims, have you ever socialized with Donald Trump in the presence of females under the age of 18? Epstein replied, though I'd like to answer that question, at least today I'm going to have to assert my 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendment rights. Other high-profile celebrities have been linked to Epstein. Britain's Prince Andrew has also been accused of sexual impropriety with a minor while he was a guest of Epstein, so he has denied the allegation. Former President Bill Clinton has also been a guest on Epstein's plane, though no allegations of abuse by Clinton have surfaced. Epstein has paid out millions to settle numerous other lawsuits alleging sexual abuse of minor females or what critics say amounts to hush money. His estate reportedly was decorated with erotica, including portraits of nude minor females. The U.S. Attorney's Office cut a plea deal with Epstein that critics contended was unfair to many alleged victims who were never notified prior to the settlement. Some claimed the plea deal may have been made to cover up embarrassing or even criminal accusations involving British royalty, other political leaders, or celebrities. It should be noted clearly that Donald Trump, unlike Epstein, has not been convicted of any sexual improprieties with minors or anyone else. However, this is not the first time Trump has been accused of sexual assault. In 1997, Jill Harth alleged that at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate, Trump forced her into his daughter's bedroom where he fondled her against her will. Harth alleged the assault occurred while she and her husband were at the property to negotiate a business deal over a beauty pageant. Trump called Harth's claims made up. She later withdrew her case, but only after a suit filed by her husband against Trump was settled. But when the Guardian newspaper recently asked her if she still stands by the sexual assault accusations, she responded, "Yes." Trump's former wife Ivanka stated under oath during a 1989 deposition that Trump, angered by a botched cosmetic surgery to cover a bald spot, ripped out her hair and violently penetrated her in what she called rape at the time. But after a divorce settlement, she said she did not mean the word rape in a, quote, literal or criminal sense, unquote, a term commonly used when victims accept settlement money in exchange for not disparaging an accused perpetrator. Jane Doe's case against Trump likely won't be heard in court until after the November election. Our justice system presumes defendants to be innocent until proven guilty. Trump has insisted that, "I love women," and he dismisses complaints of sexism or, worse, criminal abuse. But voters may wish to consider the serious character and criminal complaints against Trump in the context of his long history of publicly denigrating women, from Fox newscaster Megyn Kelly to Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina to beauty contests in the Miss Universe pageant that he runs. Trump has called women pigs, disgusting animals, and many other derogatory terms. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The border fire has claimed the lives of two people in Potrero and sparked criticism of sheriff's officials who residents say ignored their early pleas to launch a search for the missing couple. Frustrated by the slow response from officials even after a missing persons report was filed, community members formed their own search party. 10 days after the fire scorched the property where Jim and Kylie Keefe lived, women volunteers found two bodies in a rocky crevice between boulders behind the couple's burned homes. The county medical examiner's office has concluded that they died of smoke inhalation. The community set up a search website for the missing couple, and a post there indicated that the transmission on their van had died, leaving them without any way to evacuate. Cell phone and landline services were not working due to the fire, and power was also out, leaving them with no communication at all. Sheriff's officials have said they went door-to-door telling residents to evacuate, but the Keefe's property had no marked address, so no one knows if they ever received the evacuation notification. So they were left on foot with 10 dogs and no way to get out and no way to reach help. After the fire raged through their property, there were plenty of trouble signs. The site is the location where County Animal Services and 10 News reporter Joe Little rescued a dog with burned paws. Other dogs, initially believed abandoned during evacuation, were also rescued. But some dogs died, their carcasses left to rot for days by officials. Other dogs ran away from rescuers who tried to save them, repeatedly running toward a ridgeline where the bodies were eventually found. Sheriff's officials say some 8 days after the fire, they did search the home and vehicle, but they never followed the dogs onto that ridge behind the home, not even when vultures were spotted circling up above. A sheriff's press release claimed a deputy from the Campbell Sheriff Substation was first notified about the couple possibly missing on Sunday, June 26th, but he did not have their names until the next day, when a missing persons report was opened and deputies searched the property along with CAL FIRE, also checking hospitals and entering the names into a missing persons database. Authorities claim plans to bring in a search dog were underway but delayed due to the dog being diverted to Valley Center, where a missing person was at risk. But residents dispute the sheriff's version of events. Leanne Mitsui has said she repeatedly asked a sheriff's official to launch a search, but that he refused to do so. According to Mitsui, when she asked his name, he refused to provide it. Other residents at a meeting convened by Supervisor Jacob Thursday morning made similar complaints, some saying they tried for many, many days to get authorities to search for the Keefs, but that deputies were not wearing identification in the area, ignored pleas for help, and refused to disclose their names. Mitsui complained shortly before the bodies were found, nothing is being done to locate them other than locals putting out the word that they are missing. Officials are treating this as if it is a non-emergency. There has been no one there. Supervisor Jacob listened to the complaints with concern and called the actions unacceptable. A sheriff's official present promised to investigate claims of wrongdoing and made clear that all deputies are expected to be courteous and to take missing persons reports when asked. After community volunteers finally organized their own search starting at 8 a.m. on Wednesday morning, it took the women who climbed that rocky hill just 15 minutes to find the bodies, huddled together in those final desperate moments when fire and smoke overtook the young couple's hiding place. Searchers have said it wasn't hard for even amateurs to know where to look. They just followed the dog tracks and the smell of decay. The tragedy provides lessons on the importance of preparedness, the consequences of a town left without communications, the serious questions raised over officials' responses at the sheriff's department, and the power of a community to pull together and help each other when official responses fell shamefully short. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The border fire destroyed 5 homes in East County, ravaging lives and memories. In Potrero, one of the families whose home burned down had already suffered a devastating loss. Their 22-year-old son, Army Sergeant Brud Cronkrite, was killed in Iraq in 2004 when a rocket-propelled grenade was fired into a nearby building while he was on a security patrol. He was awarded a Bronze Star and Purple Heart. One Cronkrite family member witnessed the home burn to the ground, adding to the anguish. His mother told NBC 7 News that the family has now lost everything. But a sign put up by the state of California, honoring the memory of Sergeant Cronkrite, still stands at the I-8 overpass at Buckman Springs Road in Pine Valley. Family and fellow soldiers also posted memories of Brud at a Fallen Heroes Memorial site. Brud's brother, Billy, wrote, "He was a real true American hero who loved his country and his job as a soldier." Major W. Thomas Burns called Cronkrite a true patriot, adding, "He took care of his soldiers and continued to do so till the time he fell. He was a good friend to those fortunate enough to know him." Names of the other border fire victims who lost homes have not been released to the media. Anyone who suffered loss or damage to their property from the fire is urged to visit the San Diego County Recovery website at sdcountyrecovery.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Bill Driscoll.
During the border fire that started in the rural East County community of Potrero on Father's Day, some residents were away from home. Others were forced to be evacuated swiftly, unable to bring many of their pets and livestock with them. Some stayed behind, defying evacuation orders in order to care for their animals, and many wound up waging a desperate battle to save animals' lives. Throughout the fire, County Animal Services, the Humane Society, and other organizations worked to rescue hundreds of trapped animals, ranging from dogs and cats to horses, donkeys, and emus. At times, this was dangerous work, and not only from the fire. Animal workers trying to save a burned emu in Potrero were fired upon by a gun-wielding resident who was later arrested. But the situation grew increasingly dire in Potrero, where residents were left without communication since cell phone towers and landlines were damaged by the fire, and the power was also out, meaning electric well pumps for water were not working. Residents had no way to contact authorities to let them know where animals were in need. While small pets taken to a shelter in El Cajon were provided food and water, those left in Potrero, Campo, and Lake Morena were left to suffer and, in some cases, to die. Jan Hedlund, who had a satellite internet connection, was able to get a message out to East County Magazine on day 3 of the fire with the headline, Trapped. She wrote, "We're trapped in Potrero. They've now shut down our only access to Tecate, Emery Lane, where there's gas, food, and cell access. They'll let us leave, but won't let us come home. If you ask one agency, they say another agency is in charge. We cannot get assistance. We have no Red Cross help, no food for animals, no water tanks," she wrote. "There was also no fuel for generators," she added. Meanwhile, Dearhorn Valley Antler editor Kim Hamilton sent us an email that she received from Iris Gardner, who runs the Primeval Gardens Organic Farm in Potrero. Gardner described the plight. "We need animal food here. Dog food, cat food, chicken, rabbit, pig. Still finding lots of animals, dead and alive, without care," she wrote. "Just found 8 dogs, no water or food. Also some chickens that were barely hanging on." She said animal control was checking on animals in places where they received calls, but many other animals were suffering. She also indicated animal control would not enter places they considered dangerous, adding, "I'm just climbing over fences trying to find animals." Gardner asked her customers in Dearhorn Valley to organize a relief effort and find someone with credentials to access the evacuation zone. East County Magazine called Supervisor Diane Jacobs' office. "We got a call back from Michelle Clark, who put us in touch with Dan D'Souza, head of animal services. He dispatched a delivery of animal food and water to Gardner's ranch and also sent help to check on ostriches left without water that another caller told us about." The head of the Rural San Diego CERT team, or Community Emergency Response Team through Homeland Security, also responded to our plea and dispatched help to the Potrero area to help save animals in need. Meanwhile, Kim Hamilton in Dearhorn Valley, a community previously stricken by the 2007 Harris Fire, stepped up to the plate to help others now going through a similar ordeal. She teamed up with Rapture's Horse Rescue Foundation, Rancho Jamul Reserve, Border Patrol, and local businesses and residents to gather up donated supplies and arrange to get them past the roadblock, also raising $1,500 in cash in a single day. Hamilton wrote, "I have never been more proud of a community in my whole life." She added that she is just awed at the outpouring of love and care. Chantel Grivno from Rapture's Horse Rescue Foundation wrote on her Facebook page about that ordeal. "We made it. Scary dead ends, closed roads, backing trucks and horse trailers down long, winding, steep, narrow roads, and long waits, but we got all of the supplies into Potrero." The volunteers from Dearhorn Valley and the Rapture Horse Rescue Foundation headed back again a second day, loaded up with over 200 pounds of feed and 60 bales of hay. Donations poured in from PetSmart in El Cajon, the Double S Feed Store, Walmart, and other places. But the saga continued. On the Potrero Town feed on Facebook, farmer Colin Richard wrote that a very ugly scene is unfolding at the Highway 94 and 188 junction at Potrero's western end. He wrote that many farmers who left town for supplies were being turned away while trying to get back to their properties to feed and water animals at immediate risk of dying from hunger and dehydration. He said authorities blocked him, as well as others, carrying food tanks and hay bales for their animals, which he said truly are their livelihoods and savings accounts. He voiced anger, stating, "The unbending bureaucracy of the situation is inhumane, demeaning, and devastating the lives of some Potrero farmers." Fortunately, the roadblock was lifted that night, and the farmers were allowed to return home. Though for some, it was too little, too late. Eyewitnesses said there were many dead animals in Potrero, including at least 20,000 chickens at one hard-hit ranch, where authorities denied access to food and water trucks initially. Across Potrero, vultures feasted on the remains, grim symbols of the devastation. In the coming days, Grivno's Horse Rescue Group organized additional relief efforts to help animals left behind during the evacuations in Campo and Lake Morena, as the fire burned through those communities as well. The CHP, Border Patrol's Horse Detail, Department of Fish and Game, Lab Rescue, Humane Society, County Animal Services, CAL FIRE, and countless individuals all helped out in the Herculean effort to save animals across our backcountry. But the deaths of so many animals, in some cases not from fire, but starvation and dehydration, have led many residents to ask what can be done for the future to provide a more coordinated response, not relying solely on government agencies that were overwhelmed by the magnitude of the disaster, a disaster that, while devastating, at 7,900 acres, pales in comparison to the massive 2003 and 2007 firestorms, and potentially firestorms yet to come. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. ¶¶
welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Chisato Iverson, guest hosting Destination East County.
The 4th of July fireworks are over, but there are many more midsummer festivities coming up, including theatrical productions, Descanso Days, Pine Valley Days, outdoor concerts, films, star parties, a sip of Julian, and our very own Roaring Twenties party. So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Young Actors Theater invites you to step into the enchanted world of Broadway's modern classic, Disney's Beauty and the Beast. The theatrical production with live orchestra will be staged July 7th through 16th at the Joan B. Kroc Center on University Avenue in San Diego, just one block east of La Mesa. The classic story centers around Belle, a young woman in a provincial town, and the Beast, who is really a young prince trapped under the spell of an enchantress. If the Beast can learn to love and be loved, the curse will end, but the time is running out. For tickets and details, visit yatsandiego.org.
The annual Descanso Days takes place on July 9th, featuring a festival at the historic Descanso Town Hall and a parade rolling out at 10 a.m. This year's theme is A Blaze of Glory. Be sure to arrive early since Viejas Grade Road shuts down before the parade, and stay late to enjoy games, food, vendor booths, and entertainment. You can learn more at descansotownhall.org.
Once a month, the San Diego Astronomy Association, Tierra del Sol Observing Site, and the 22-inch LIP Telescope in rural East County are open to the public. This month, the event will be July 9th from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. The public is invited to come view celestial bodies through club telescopes. For directions and details, you can visit the San Diego Astronomy Association website at sdaa.org and click on the Tierra del Sol Resources section.
What could be more delightful on a summer's eve than to savor supper in a vineyard with an array of tantalizing menus and wines? Hatfield Creek Vineyards in Ramona is hosting summer suppers on the second Sunday each month at 4 p.m. with a limit of 20 guests. On July 10th, the winery is serving up pork tenderloin with mango chutney, rice pilaf, grilled asparagus, and chocolate mousse parfait for dessert. For reservations or details on this and other upcoming events, you can visit hatfieldcreekvineyards.com.
The City of La Mesa's Family Fun Sundays at 6 concert series will be held once again in Harry Griffin Park each Sunday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. On July 10th, Sonic Epidemic will be playing horn tunes of the 70s. On July 17th, Silvermine will be performing classic rock and pop.
The shortlist is back in Lemon Grove. Summer Film Night takes place each Wednesday evening now through July 27th at 6:30 p.m. in the Lemon Grove Library. Comedy, drama, animation, and documentary from the long-running PBS series The Shortlist, now a cult classic among viewers who relish great short films, will remind you that the world is large and never dull. The season is sponsored by the Lemon Grove Historical Society and the Lemon Grove Library, and made possible by New Pacific Productions. The Shortlist is geared to a general audience ages 18 and over.
Night fishing continues at Santee Lakes on Thursday evenings, July 21st, August 4th, and August 18th from 5 to 11:30 p.m. A lantern is required and no radios are allowed. Learn more at santeelakes.com.
Santee Lakes will also host Movies and More by the Lakes on July 15th at 6 p.m. with a showing of The Princess Bride, which is rated PG. Gates open at 4 p.m. There will be food trucks, a snack bar, and other fun activities, too. For more information, you can visit santeelakes.com.
Disney's The Lion King has captivated the imagination of audiences around the world, and now, for the first time ever, Christian Youth Theater San Diego has the opportunity to produce this one-of-a-kind musical on July 21st through 24th at the Helix Main Stage Theater in La Mesa. The African savanna comes to life on stage with Simba, Rafiki, and an unforgettable cast of characters as they journey from Pride Rock to the jungle, and back again in this inspiring coming-of-age tale. For tickets, you can visit cytsandiego.org.
Pine Valley Days will take place July 29th and 30th in the mountain town of Pine Valley. A highlight of the two-day festival is a parade along Old Highway 80 through Pine Valley on July 29th, starting at 9 a.m., featuring horses, bagpipes, clowns, cars, dragons, marching bands, and more. Other activities include a craft village at the Pine Valley County Park on Saturday, Friday night deep pit barbecue and dancing in the park after dark, plus a burrito breakfast on Saturday and a music festival. For full details, you can visit pinevalleydays.com.
The Julian Chamber of Commerce is hosting the second annual Sip of Julian on Saturday, July 30th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. The SIP features growers and producers of wine, craft beer, hard cider, and mead, an ancient honey-based beverage offering up samplings of their own handcrafted specialties. Samples will be paired with small bites at each venue, where you can also take in the scenery and spend a relaxing day enjoying the sights and sounds of Julian, a historic gold rush town. Proceeds will benefit Julian's annual country Christmas and tree lighting celebration. For tickets and information, visit julianca.com and click on events.
East County Magazine invites you to our very own Roaring Twenties party on Sunday, July 31st from 4 to 7 p.m. Don your flapper, gangster, or 20s film style attire and join the festivities at the San Pasqual Winery Tasting Room in La Mesa. Entertainment includes singers and dancers from Visionary Dance Theater performing a preview of their upcoming production of Chicago, as well as 20s-era film showings and prizes. Get in the spirit of the ragtime and jazz age at our Party of the Century, complete with a catered Italian feast that Al Capone and the Great Gatsby would have loved, all to benefit our nonprofit public media outlet. For reservations and tickets, you can visit eastcountymagazine.org.
The Julian Starfest is a free public star party in Julian that will take place August 6th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. You can take a star tour of the heavens using the many telescopes set up in the viewing area. Experts will be on hand to answer questions. Parking is available nearby, and it is suggested that you bring a red light flashlight to guide yourself to the observing area. If you don't have a red light flashlight, red film will be provided to cover a white light flashlight. Please, no white lights in the observing area. Find out more at julianstarfest.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org. If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back again next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, my very special guest is Lisa Wood, who is a Lakeside resident and a long rider. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
Can you explain for our listeners exactly what a long rider is?
Well, there's an organization called the Long Riders Guild, and their criteria for whether or not you can be in their guild is you have to have ridden 1,000 miles or more without support.
And we're not talking about on a car or bicycle here.
No. The Long Riders Guild is a horseback rider. So the Long Riders Guild is specifically for people that travel by horseback without support.
Now, you have ridden cross-country twice, once from Southern California, Oregon, once from Southern California all the way to Pennsylvania on the East Coast. And I understand you're considering a third one along the old Spanish Trail. What compelled you to get started on this?
Well, a book. I enjoy reading other people's travel books, and I read one that was republished in 1987, so I didn't initially know when I purchased the book that it was about a ride that actually occurred in 1911. But in 1911, a fairly famous Californian named Joseph Smeaton Chase took his horse Chino and rode from his home in the Los Angeles area to the Oregon border. And he published a book about it. It was one of three books about traveling in California that he published. One was his coastal trip. That's the one I happened to purchase. He also wrote one about a trip to Yosemite and one about a trip through the desert in the Palm Springs area.
So then in 1993, you repeated his trip, or at least as much of it as could be replicated given the freeways and sprawl in Los Angeles these days. So what did your friends say, when you said, hey, I'm going to go ride to Oregon? Were they supportive or what?
Well, there were a few who were very supportive. For example, we have a local saddle maker named Gary McClintock, he helped me out. I got the exact same kind of saddle Mr. Chase used. He used a McClellan saddle, and I found an elderly gentleman in El Cajon selling a used one that was an authentic antique, and so I used the exact same kind of saddle. It needed a little bit of work, so Gary did some work on that saddle for me, and he was very supportive. So there were a few people that were supportive, but there were a whole lot of people that thought I had lost my mind. And they had all had their very serious reasons for why I couldn't do this. And having never done it before, I didn't know if I even could. In fact, Gary recommended that I get some advice from a gentleman who'd done quite a bit of rugged riding. And in the advice, he was teaching me how to make fires by rubbing sticks together. I brought matches with me, by the way. But this gentleman,
Did you do that?
I used matches. He was kind of shaking his head, and what he wasn't saying, but what he meant was I was too young, I was too inexperienced, and I was definitely too female to do a ride like this.
Oh, my goodness. How old were you at the time?
I was in my 30s the time.
That's not exactly.
I didn't think it was that young. I had never been actually camping overnight with my horse. In fact, I didn't own a horse at the time.
Really? you had been riding though since you were little. I know you told me in the lobby about a little experience of your first experience on horseback at 3 years old. Can you share that with our listeners?
I'll share that, but I'll, as a preface, say that from the time I was three until I took my first long ride, I was what we call a horseless rider, in that I rode a lot. But typically people paid me to ride their horses for them. Often I was the first one to ride the horse.
You broke the horses then.
I rode people's problem horses. I started horses. I exercised horses. So I had the opportunity to ride a lot of different horses and learn a lot of different styles, which was very advantageous. I got my horse, my first horse, for this long ride is why I got him.
Fascinating.
But my first ride, you asked about my first experience. No one else in my family rides horses. My dad rode a little bit when he was growing up, but I grew up in suburban Bakersfield.
And your mom was a Girl Scout leader.
And my mom was a Girl Scout leader. And unfortunately, in Valley Fever, it's a fungal disease that when the earth gets disturbed and the wind blows, people get very sick.
And so your mother caught Valley Fever.
And my mother caught Valley Fever, so she couldn't take the Girl Scouts that my older sister was in a Girl Scout troop. She couldn't take them horseback riding as they had been promised, and the co-leader didn't want to take the kids, but nobody wanted to disappoint the kids, so my dad agreed. So my dad took the Girl Scouts out horseback riding, but my mom was too sick to look after me, so a little three-year-old tyke came along on the horseback ride. So that was my first horseback ride, and my dad had to contend with trying to get the girls out on the ride and deal with the little three-year-old, and had some difficulty keeping all the girls riding, and they ended up heading back toward the stable, and apparently mine was as barn sour as any, and Dad chased me all the way, but my horse got back first and scared the living daylights out of my dad, as he tells the story. When he scooped me out of the saddle, instead of being all scared, I said, Daddy, my horsey, go.
Well, and you've been going on horses ever since then, it sounds like. Now, the first ride that you took to Oregon, how long did it take you?
That took 3.5 months. That was on that first horse that I purchased for the trip. Mm-hmm. His name was Cacho. Unfortunately, he had to be put down last year. Mm-hmm. He had liver cancer, but he was 28. He lived a good long life.
Is there a highlight that stands out from that trip for you?
Well, I'll tell you, for both long rides, there are two main points, and the first is that there are just a whole lot of very good and helpful people who would drop everything to help me out along the way. That's the first point. And the second point is we live in a fabulously beautiful place, and the coast of California is just absolutely spectacular. For example, I got to ride an area called the Avenue of the Giants, with the giant redwoods on both sides and elk grazing in the meadow. Just spectacular. 17-mile drive in the Monterey area. I rode that on horseback with the crashing surf and the rocky coastline. Some spectacularly beautiful places.
What an amazing experience. Now, that was in 1993. Then in 2001, you decided to ride along three historic trails, the Kearney Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, and the Old National Road, all the way basically from Southern California to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and then from Santa Fe to St. Louis, and from there onto the East Coast. How long did that trip take you?
That took 5 months. And if you do the math, you'll see that the horse that I rode to Virginia, it's a different horse, it's my Mustang mare, mm-hmm. she picked up the pace a little bit. She averaged 20 miles a day, whereas Cacho, on the first trip, he averaged 15 miles a day. So the second trip on my more energetic Mustang mare, it took 5 months to cover 3,000 miles. And I'll tell you that 20 miles a day, you know, if you're driving in a car, that doesn't seem like very far. If you're riding on a horse day after day after day for 5 months, 20 miles is a long way. And I was tired at the end of every day. I was ready to crawl in that mm-hmm. tent and get some shut-eye. And my mare was never tired. I would tie her to a tree or a bush or a fence or something like that, and she'd be pacing around. Come on, put the gear back on. Let's go some more.
Wow. Now, I understand that you had a few hair-raising moments on that trip. What happened?
Oh, gosh. Well, probably one of the biggest hazards, even in the days of the wagon train, was weather. And the weather hasn't gotten any easier from the days of the wagon trains until now. And I was within 10 miles of two tornadoes. The second tornado that was very close to where I was in Dodge City, Kansas. And there was a good situation for Shawnee and me because we had been introduced to a man who had some big barns and a lot of other horses. And so we had a place to shelter, although if the tornado actually hits, the shelter's not going to help. It only helps in the heavy
Wizard of Oz.
Exactly. So I was helping this. Brad Marshall was the man's name. He runs this Wild West show for the tourists in Dodge City, Kansas.
Wow.
And I was helping him feed his animals in the storm. And he looked up at the sky with the thunder and lightning and the rain coming down. And he, in his slow Kansas drawl, said, "Well, if it turns into a twister, I'll come up to the barn and get you and bring you down to the cellar."
Oh, boy.
I looked at Shawnee and I said, "Well, it's going to be one heck of a night because I was spending the night in the barn with Shawnee unless he came up to get me to take me down into the cellar."
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
As it turned out, that tornado didn't hit Dodge City. It hit a nearby town called Rolla, and there were two fatalities in Rolla.
Oh, my goodness. I understand that you're considering taking yet another long ride, and this one would be along the old Spanish Trail. Where exactly is that?
Well, the old Spanish Trail predates the Santa Fe Trail, but it's the same kind of idea. When Spain was in charge of New Mexico and Santa Fe and the little settlements throughout there, they forbade trade with California. So it wasn't until 1822 that trade routes could happen, and it took a little while before there was a wagon route. So before the wagon route, there was a mule route. So the mule route from Santa Fe to California in 1822 developed very quickly, and it went from Santa Fe to California to the trading centers in California, which would have been the Los Angeles area and Monterey.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating trip as well, and we'll look forward to hearing all about that. Now, you have written two books about your first two trips. Tell us the names of those and a little bit about what people can read in them.
So the first trip on Cacho is called Chasing the California Dream. It moves along very quickly. The first draft of it, I had a whole lot of California history and California natural history. In the version I published, I cut it down to just mostly my stories about the adventures that Cacho and I had going to Oregon. And the second one is called Mustang Journal because the mare I rode to Virginia was born on Bureau of Land Management land. She's a wild Mustang.
Oh, wow.
And in that, I did include a little bit of the history from the historical trails that I was retracing. So there's a little bit of history in that one as well as my personal adventures.
Fascinating. Where can people find the books Chasing the California Dream and Mustang Journal?
Those are available on Amazon.com. The new copies of Mustang Journal are sold out, but there are still used copies available, and there are still new copies of Chasing the California Dream available, and yeah, maybe one day I'll do a ebook version.
Well, very good, and we certainly look forward to having you back when you chase your next dream on the Old Spanish Trail. Thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you, Mary.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.